Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a historic turn for Myanmar. A U.S. call for China to exert its leverage over Pyongyang to denuclearize. We go for a new virtual reality roller coaster ride.
It was exciting. I'm telling you, you could see the buildings. You were firing missiles.
And we hear about Ariana Grande and her new song, Dangerous Woman. It's right here on The Voice of America. Myanmar's parliament today swore in the country's first civilian president with no ties to the military in more than half a century, following November's landslide election by the National League for Democracy. Tin Jaw, a close confidant of democracy leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, pledges to remain loyal to the Union of Myanmar, also known as Burma. Mindful of the country's ethnic divisions, Tin Jaw said the new government will pursue national reconciliation, the peace process, and establish a democratic federal union, as well as work to develop the livelihood and living standards of the people. But analysts say the success of the new government will depend on its relations with the military, which has dominated the country since 1962 and still holds a portion of parliament's seats. Sean Turrell is a longtime analyst of Myanmar at Australia's Makerere University. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the swearing-in of Tin Jaw, who replaced former General Thein Sein, is highly significant and a big step in Myanmar's slow transition to democracy.
It's not the full democracy we might have hoped for, of course, because the military still have a very strong role in the country, in the economy. And likewise, most Burmese people, when they went to vote, thought they were voting for Aung San Suu Kyi to be president, but that wasn't allowed on the constitution. So it's not democracy in full measure, but it's democracy in large measure. And so for that reason, it's a very special day.
Well, Aung San Suu Kyi herself will hold four portfolios: the president's office, energy, education, and foreign affairs. Obviously, she's going to have a big impact.
She sure is. She's going to be very much there behind the scenes as well, of course, even beyond the portfolio itself. But the portfolio is extremely important anyway. I think it's important that she grabbed those posts, particularly in terms of foreign affairs. There's a technical reason there, because that gives her access to the National Security Council, which is in many ways the most powerful body in Myanmar. But, of course, she's also very much the public face of Myanmar anyway. And so having that portfolio gives an opportunity as well to be in all the discussions that involves Myanmar in the international community.
Well, Sean, despite the massive landslide of last November that brought the NLD into power, will not the success of this civil administration depend on its relations with the military?
It sure will. That's the critical relationship, and it's the reason for all of the sensitivities. As you mentioned, the electoral mandate of Suu Kyi and the NLD is overwhelming, but nonetheless, the constitution dictates that the military will play a really important role. And so that relationship between the new democratic government and the military members of the parliament and the military itself, which also just holds some very important portfolios, obviously including defence, including things like home affairs as well, will be critically important.
Sean Turnell says the new government will have its hands full in trying to end ethnic conflicts and lift people out of poverty while moving toward full democracy and maintaining good ties to the military. Time for a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story. And joining me with details is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew. You tell me there's not a whole lot.
There isn't a whole lot about this Myanmar story because Myanmar is very restrictive with social media still. It's very hard to access Twitter, Facebook, some of the other social media that we use in other parts of the world. But what we're seeing so far from little bits and pieces from within the country, but mostly outside the country, is just generally a sense of hope that this is going to help them move forward, embrace democracy, and a lot of that hope coming from throughout the region. So even though it's not coming specifically from Myanmar, it's coming from other countries around Myanmar where people can access social media. So just a lot of hope, a lot of optimism being expressed as this momentous occasion occurs.
Well, it's been a long time coming.
Absolutely, absolutely. And something else that's actually been a long time coming is my segue into our next story. Instagram has announced that it is expanding the videos that you can post on Instagram. Right now, you can post up to 15 seconds of video. They're saying that so many people have embraced video and so many people are using video on Instagram that they're expanding it to 60 seconds.
Isn't that the length of time that a commercial can go on there?
Exactly. So it's going to change things, I think, for advertising and certainly for, you know, people, celebrities who want to film things, everyday people who are filming things. You have a lot longer period of time to work with, four times as much time as you did before. And Instagram said that because so many people are embracing video, that they're adding this feature. They said that their video views have increased drastically over the past year. And so because so many people are using it not as a photo app but as a video app, they said, well, we're going to change with the times and extend it.
Doesn't this also make them more competitive, though, with the other folks out there?
Absolutely. Twitter, with their video, I think you can post up to 20 or 30 seconds on Twitter. Facebook doesn't have a limit, and Facebook Live also, you can go up to 90 minutes, I think, doing a live broadcast. So I think it's part of the changing times, which is interesting because social media was always everything very quick. As you know, Vine started out, it was a 6-second video service, and now it's slowly expanding more and more.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
2 days before President Obama meets the leaders of Japan, China, and South Korea over North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, Deputy U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has called on China to exert its leverage over Pyongyang to denuclearize.
China says sometimes that it has lost or doesn't have influence with the regime. And it's fair to say that based on the fact that it sent senior envoys to North Korea only to have the regime turn around the next day and test a missile or a nuclear device, there's something to that. But there's a difference between influence and leverage. And even if its influence has diminished, its leverage has not. There's a unique relationship between China and North Korea economically. The Security Council resolution really puts that front and center on the table. And we hope that the collaboration with China on North Korea will continue.
Blinken, in remarks to a Washington think tank, said if Beijing doesn't want the U.S. to take additional steps for its own security and that of its allies, the best thing it can do is to engage in dealing with North Korea. He called on China to take a lead role in implementing new U.N. Security Council sanctions over the North's recent nuclear and missile tests. China opposes deployment of a U.S. anti-missile system in South Korea, currently being negotiated. Troy Sangarone of the Korea Economic Institute says that while it appears to have dwindling influence over North Korea, Beijing still has significant leverage.
I think if we look back through all the various nuclear tests and other challenges we've faced with North Korea, what we see is that China often will go to the North Koreans and suggest that they not test either missiles or nuclear weapons. On occasion, the North Koreans have listened to the Chinese, but often they've ignored that advice. I think what we've seen over time is that progressively, especially under Kim Jong-un, they listen to the Chinese less and less in terms of these types of national security issues. And so while they may have less influence in terms of getting the North Koreans to follow through on prospective policies, they do still hold leverage over North Korea in terms of their economic ties, both in terms of trade and also FDI that they provide to North Korea. And it's through these types of levers that the hope is they can take and try to convince the North Koreans to come back to the negotiating table and talk about the nuclear program rather than continue testing both missiles and nuclear weapons.
Is the Sino-North Korean relationship at a crossroads?
I think it's been getting progressively more tense over the last few years. We've seen under Xi Jinping an effort to take and move from a party-to-party relationship to a state-to-state relationship. As part of that process, though, we've also seen North Korea push back.
And what is on the agenda for this week's Nuclear Security Summit in Washington?
I think the first thing they'll talk about is where they are currently in terms of implementation of the sanctions. Once they've gone through and discussed how to approach the sanctions, how best to take and continue to try and convince the North Koreans to refrain from further tests, especially given that there's been discussion that North Koreans might engage in a fifth nuclear test, then it will likely turn to Chinese requests for a resumption of talks. However, I think there's certain difficulties in returning to talks right now in the sense that, one, North Korea is likely uninterested in talks. And two, I think it would be very difficult to return to talks under the conditions the North Koreans have presented, which is a discussion of a peace treaty rather than the nuclear program. Without discussion of the nuclear program, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for the United States. Actually, it would be impossible for the United States to engage in talks.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The World Health Organization describes malaria as a life-threatening disease caused by parasites that are spread to people when they are bitten by infected female mosquitoes. Some think that the disease originated as recently as 15,000 years ago. Now, researchers at Oregon State University have traced the origins of malaria and find that it has evolved for at least 100 million years. They say the first vertebrates to be infected were most likely reptiles, and at that time, this group of animals included dinosaurs. But instead of mosquitoes spreading the malaria parasite to its victims, these prehistoric forms of the disease were carried by other insects, such as a family of small flies called the biting midge. The researchers say that understanding malaria's evolution could help scientists develop new methods to stop its transmission. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States says more can and must be done with regards to boosting intelligence sharing in Europe following last week's deadly terror attacks in Brussels. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the attacks at the Brussels airport and metro are a reminder of how important it is for the basic fundamentals of intelligence and national security procedures to be followed. Joining us here in the studio is National Affairs correspondent Jeff Selden. Welcome, Jeff.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Well, let's just ask that same question. Are basic fundamentals of intelligence and national security procedures not being followed in Europe?
Well, they are being followed in Europe. The problem is that Europe isn't like the United States, where you know, from state to state, you may have some different laws, but the national laws are the same. From country to country, you have different capabilities, different laws, different procedures that have to be followed. Everyone in Europe also has been scrambling to make sure that they're in compliance with different European Union regulations that they also have to follow. It makes it very complicated, and it's something that the European security agencies and law enforcement agencies have been struggling with, even at times. And this is something that the U.S. went through post 9/11, the terror attacks of September 11, 2001, where there were clues out there, there were bits of information, but the agencies weren't set up to be able to connect all the dots. Europe has been struggling with that. It is getting better. Western diplomatic sources, European law enforcement sources that I've spoken with say there has been a change, that there's a change on the ground as they go through this investigation, trying to track down the cells that were involved in the Brussels terrorist attack. There are teams on the ground there specifically to share information with different agencies across Europe as they try to delve into this web of terror cells that the Islamic State has created in Europe and has now used to carry out at least two successful attacks.
And I heard, which is a minor point, but the language barrier is also there. You have so many police speaking different languages in different regions with different customs, different communication systems. It gets complicated.
It does get complicated, especially when you go to the lower levels where you're talking about police in a town or border security. You know, people who are law enforcement but maybe are not high up. And that also gets into another language type of problem with the language of IT, whereas the systems, not all the European systems, are able to communicate with each other. And that's something, again, they've been working on. Earlier this year, the Europol set up the European Counter-Terror Center. And one of the things that it's been working on, and it's been working with the U.S., is how does it take all its systems, all its data, and merge it so that people can look things up quickly and efficiently. It's something that officials say they've made some progress on. Obviously, they say more needs to be made.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for stopping by.
Anytime.
Coming up on International Edition, hold on tight for the virtual reality roller coaster. And a dangerous woman takes to song. The next generation of the roller coaster experience has arrived. Correspondent Elizabeth Lee checked a new virtual reality roller coaster at a Los Angeles, California amusement park called Six Flags Magic Mountain and spoke to the ride's developer, Thomas Wagner. Here's what she found out.
On this clear morning, Jesse Cotton and his mother are ready to experience the unknown.
It was exciting. I'm telling you, you could see the buildings, you were firing missiles. It's exciting.
Because you're wearing goggles, you can't see the track. You don't know what's about to come.
Cotton is about to ride the roller coaster again. He's one of the first people to experience a virtual reality roller coaster. It's a traditional ride that is transformed when riders put on Samsung's Gear VR headset. It's a Samsung phone paired with virtual reality goggles. there is a box on the roller coaster that maps the ride. It knows exactly the position of the ride and sends a Bluetooth signal to the rider's headset, resulting in what the person sees.
For every coaster, we have to figure out where do we place our black box that is transmitting the Bluetooth signal. Do we have a good reception in all of the seats?
The maker of this experience says not every type of roller coaster is a candidate for the virtual reality experience.
We had bad experience going on wooden coasters, for instance, for the vibration. So the headset would be vibrating, the electronics would be vibrating heavily, and that's not that good. But all the steel coasters of the world would be able to be equipped.
This roller coaster, called the New Revolution, is made of steel and takes riders on a journey to fight aliens from the sky in this virtual city.
You look down and everything's moving with you. Really felt like you're the pilot of this fighter jet. And you're definitely gonna jump out of your seat a few times.
So my plane is about to take off, and above me I see the sky and an entire city with skyscrapers around me and planes flying around me. Woo! You can look all around you. You're completely surrounded by this world. Wow, that was quite an experience. Nothing like I've ever experienced before. Nine Six Flags parks in North America will be debuting virtual reality roller coasters this year, creating a completely new experience for thrill seekers. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A thunderstorm overtakes an airport, a terrifying experience for someone who's afraid to fly. But this situation's not real. It's just playing out on a smartphone inside of a virtual reality headset for a patient with phobias.
For me, everything was stressful. Before, flying was stressful. It was stressful to go to the airport. The takeoff was stressful.
But that was before Gerardo Gary started treatment in Argentina with psychiatrists from the Poder Volar organization in Buenos Aires. And Gerardo says he's now cured of his fear of flying. Psychiatrist Claudio Pla.
Virtual reality is wonderful for therapists because it allows us to recreate the feared scenario in an office.
The psychiatrist can control the intensity of the feared virtual experience, but they say the treatment must be used in combination with real experience for phobia patients to improve. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
It's time for our music chat with Larry London, and he joins me here in the studio, and he's going to talk to us about a song that he says is all about me. The song is called Dangerous Woman.
Yes.
And that is me.
Dangerous Woman. Only this time around, though, it's Ariana Grande who's the Dangerous Woman. She is releasing her third album, which is titled Dangerous Woman. Interesting story, the album was supposed to come out last year, and originally it was called Moonlight. But she decided she didn't like the songs. She redid the album. She stopped a tour that she was about to start. You hear that often these days where people start a tour and stop a tour because they're not satisfied with the product. And so such is the case for Ariana Grande, who began her career on Nickelodeon on a TV show called Victorious and became quite famous a number of years ago for her acting. And then she released an album, and now she's got a new album coming out, and her fans are very excited.
Well, are you going to rate this one? Sometimes you say this is going to be a number one hit. Sometimes, what do you think?
I'm not going to go that far this time around. I mean, Ariana Grande is okay. In my book, this is only my personal opinion now. She has a following. She has fans. She's had a number of big hits. But I don't think she possesses the star power and the sound that's necessary to sustain a number one song. I hope she proves me wrong. But I know she was in the news last year for less than stellar decision. She was in a donut shop and she licked a donut.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
It was a gross out.
Exactly. It was a gross out. So she caught some slack from her fans for that. She has said some other comments that were disparaging. She said, I don't like America. She later retracted that and apologized. She said a number of different things that have kind of set her back a little bit. She's been known to have diva-esque behavior, and people just say that she's really not worthy of it at this point. With only two albums out and a third coming out, she hasn't earned the diva label yet.
No, she's not quite up there with Cher and
Madonna.
Exactly,
Mariah Carey, Madonna, all those others who have put in the time and paid their dues. Ariana Grande also put out two perfume lines in the last 8 months, the latest of which is named for her brother, Frankie. So she's venturing off into different directions, and so her new music is coming off the new album. We're looking forward to hearing the whole album when it comes out.
Well, is it worth it for us to download Dangerous Woman?
Yeah, sure. If you don't mind Ariana Grande and you like her sound, then yeah. I mean, she was a guest recently on Saturday Night Live. She was the host, the musical host and guest, and so she did an imitation of a bunch of different people.
Oh, I saw that. She was great.
Yes, she was.
She was really amazing.
She did Britney Spears. She did Celine Dion. She did Rihanna.
She was right on top of them.
Exactly. She did a great job with each, and apparently she said that Celine Dion was thrilled with her impression. And so, yeah, Ariana Grande has many talents, but I think it's still very early in her career.
Well, maybe she should take on some of these other singing qualities she has and
that's
pursue
right. Do
her
a
career.
Whole album with nothing but other singers'
yes.
voices.
That'd be great. Hey, Larry, before you go, I wanted to ask you, could you please tell my listeners how to get into your show so they can hear it?
Well, you can do it several different ways. VOAnews.com, go to programs, and then TV, and then Border Crossings, because we're on TV on the Internet. And you can also go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/VOA Larry London.
Do you look as cute on TV as you do here, Larry?
No, I wish I did, but I don't. Oh. I look a lot taller on the radio.
Oh. Thanks a lot, Larry. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Susan.
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For the first time, the United States is working with the naval forces of Gulf of Guinea nations in a joint exercise to improve the region's preparedness and capability to combat piracy, narcotics trafficking, and other maritime threats. The combined exercise, Oban Game Saharan Express 2016, was officially launched on March 17, 2016, at Senegalese National Marine Naval Base by authorities of the participating and observing countries. Cameroon is the official host of the exercise, with elements of the exercise taking place in other participating countries. The northernmost hub of the exercise, Senegal, was chosen to host the opening ceremony. The ceremony was presided over by U.S. Embassy Chargé d'Affaires Sandra Clark, Chief of Staff of the Senegalese Navy Rear Admiral Chekbar Osisoko, and the Commander U.S. 6th Fleet Vice Admiral James Fogo. Exercise Oban Game Saharan Express is a multinational maritime exercise sponsored by U.S. Africa Command and facilitated by U.S. Naval Forces, Europe Africa, U.S. 6th Fleet, that brings together African, European, South American, and U.S. forces, part of a global network of navies, to enhance cooperation and expertise in maritime security operations. The exercise will take place throughout the Gulf of Guinea and will have land-based maritime operations centers throughout the region. In the past, Oban Game Express and Saharan Express were separate exercises that took place in different areas of West Africa. This year, they have been combined to increase capacity building for more partners across West Africa. There are 27 participating nations in Oban Game Saharan Express 2016. Angola, Benin, Belgium, Brazil, Cameroon, Cabo Verde, Côte d'Ivoire, Democratic Republic of Congo, Denmark, Equatorial Guinea, France, Gabon, Germany, Ghana, Morocco, the Netherlands, Nigeria, Portugal, Republic of Congo, Sao Tome and Principe, Senegal, South Africa, Spain, Togo, Turkey, United States, and the United Kingdom, as well as the Economic Community of West African States and the Economic Community of Central African States. This Oban Game Saharan Express 2016 exercise ended with a symposium in Douala, Cameroon. The United States is proud to work with its international partners to keep the seaways to Africa open and safe for the benefit of all the peoples of Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.